So what I'd like to talk about is what we know and what we hope to learn about extrasolar Jupiters in particular. I don't want to get into smaller planets or terrestrial planet finder or any of that. And more than that, I'd like to concentrate on kind of a short fuse future. What do I think we might at least begin to start learning in the next 5 or 10 years? It's just sort of projections of current technology. So those of you who remember the Watergate days, this isn't exactly what did the president know and when did he know it, but it's that kind of idea. And I'm particularly interested in the physical properties of planets as opposed to their sort of orbital or dynamical properties. And so those are the things that I'll try to emphasize. And because I'm going to be talking about a lot of different detection techniques, I don't plan to talk about any of them in very much detail. And so if you want me to justify anything that I say, you're going to have to ask me questions. You're right, the wind here is great. Stay put, you.
Hey, moving forward on the table, Tim.
Learning from experience. Okay, so what are the approaches I want to talk about? I'm going to reprise Tristan's discussion of radial velocities very briefly. Talk a little bit about transit photometry, and then reflected light measurements, with or without transits. Question what you might learn by observing the thermal emission from Jupiter-sized planets. And then finally, the topic that's nearest and dearest to my heart right now, which is transit spectroscopy. And I'll probably spend the most time on that and kind of rush through this other stuff. So, radial velocities. What do we know about planets? The answer is, outside our solar system, not very much, but almost all of it comes from radial velocity measurements. And I just made a list of things that I think one can say with justification. So there are about 50 planets known outside the solar system, around almost 50, but significantly fewer than that, stars. So about 5% of the surveyed stars that are like the Sun seem to have a roughly Jupiter mass planet or more surrounding them. Multiple systems are fairly common. If you want to find an extrasolar planet, an extrasolar Jupiter, the best place to look for one is close to another one, as it turns out. Your chances of coming up with a second one, if you found a first one, are, they're 1 in 5 or something like that, as opposed to 1 in 20 if you look at a random star. So that's kind of interesting. As Tristan pointed out, the orbital radii are often very small as 0.04 astronomical units. And so it's kind of a mystery how these planets got to where they are. Probably the single most interesting thing, in fact, about the planets that we found outside the solar system is this weird distribution of orbital radii. Masses run from about Saturn's mass. This is M sine I, actually, so it's the minimum estimate of the mass, up to, and you can tell this view graph was written last night, 17 Jupiter masses, after hearing Jeff Marcy's press conference yesterday. But there is this pileup at low masses, which is contrary to the biases that you'd expect from the method. The radial velocity method works better on big mass things. You see more low mass things. Chances are there really are more low mass things. Another peculiarity about the orbits is that they are usually eccentric, and I think almost the only exceptions to that rule are planets that are so close to their stars that tidal circularization has had time to circularize the orbits. And so somehow these planets either get born or get moved into orbits that are much more eccentric than what we typically see in the solar system. And it would be nice to know how that comes about. And then finally, there's this point that Tristan also mentioned, that there's good evidence that there's a tendency for planets to be found around stars that are metal-rich. And I might mention here that the search for transiting planets in 47 Tucani, which is about a factor of 4 metal poor compared to the Sun, turned up nothing flat. We expected to see 15 or 20 planets in there, and we found none. So this may work in the other direction, too.
Can I ask you a naive question?
Yeah.
The fact that you're using Wigglesworth, in the Doppler shift,
yeah,
doesn't that select toward high-eccentric orbits?
No. The effect of the eccentricity is to distort the Doppler shift curves, but the amplitude
is just given by
The maximum velocity. So in a sense, you're selecting for the distance of closest passage.
There is a solid bias. And people should worry about that bias.
That's, yeah. But there's no... That's fair enough, sure.
Some people would say that the eccentricity is the most remarkable thing.
Yeah, I think there's an argument that's defensible. It says that these extrasolar planets may be formed by a mechanism that's completely different from that formed our planets, and so maybe we're learning nothing about our own solar system by looking at these extrasolar planets.
Which implies that we've learned nothing about planets in general from our own solar system.
Wow.
If you look at human history, you might argue that we just learned nothing. But.
Now we're learning a hell of a lot by looking at Galapagos, and Galapagos is not typically
there. And that's about all I want to say about radial velocities, except to just go back over this list and point out that the information you get about the physical properties of the planet is very small. It's some sort of a number that relates to the mass. It's a minimum mass estimate. And that's really all you get out. And so in particular, you can say nothing about the composition, or these things could have square corners as far as you know. So a way to learn some more is transit photometry. And there the idea, which I neglected to bring a nice picture. This is probably obvious to everybody, but let me draw you a picture anyway. I don't know about you, but I think in pictures. So, also, here we are. So this is simple geometry. So you've got a star with a planet going around it. And if you're fortunate, things are lined up like this, so that once per orbit, the planet passes between you and the star, and once per orbit, it passes behind. The probability that will happen is the ratio of the stellar diameter to the planet's orbital diameter. And so if you have a planet that's 10 stellar radii away, which is typical for these hot Jupiters, your chances of being lined upright are about 1 in 10. For the Earth going around the Sun, your chances are 0.5%. And so maybe a better example is that for Jupiter going around the Sun, your chances are 0.004. It's real small. And it happens once every 12 years. And so the reason that nobody bothered to look for transits around other stars was when we thought all solar systems looked like our solar system. It's really a losing game. You're looking for Jupiter is a tenth of the solar radius, and so it blocks 1% of the Sun's area when it passes in front. You're looking for a 1% dip that lasts for about a day, happens once every 12 years, and your chances of seeing it are about 1 in 1,000. So, would you invest a career in that?
Somebody did.
Anyway, the odds get much better once you know they're hot Jupiters, because now your chances are 1 in 10. The orbital period is 4 days, so if you miss it tonight, then you don't have to come back a whole solar cycle later. And so it becomes a more reasonable thing to do. Nevertheless, so far we only have one example of an extrasolar planet that passes in front of its star. That's HD 209458, henceforth HD whatever, is what I'll call it. And that one was discovered as a radial velocity variable first. And so once radial velocity planets are found, they're routinely examined photometrically to see if transits occur. And in this one, they do. And so what do we know? Well, what you have to do is you have to watch the planet go in front of the star. And I guess you've seen this picture, but my opinion is you can't show this picture too often. So this is a light curve that Ron Gilliland and Dave Charbonneau and I and a couple of other collaborators got with space telescope data taken April, May of last year. So basically we looked at a big chunk of spectrum, because that's the only way we could get as many photons as we needed, and collapsed all the light into one photometric measurement and did that as a function of time. So this is the brightness of the star as seen by space telescope as a function of time, with actually four different transits folded on top of one another. This is days, and notice that this transit is 1.6% deep, and so that's some measurement of how large the planet is. The red dots are the observations, and the blue line is a model. Let me tell you about the model. Well, first let me just tell you about sort of the fitting process. So if you have this planet passing in front of the star, you get a light curve, and you can think of it as really there are four things that you can measure in this light curve at the level of precision that we can attain. One of them is how wide is it from sort of center point to center point? How deep is it? What's the slope going in and coming out? And what about the curvature on the bottom? Is it flat or is it curved? Now, with those four numbers, you can derive the diameter of the planet, the diameter of the star, this impact parameter as the planet crosses the disk, and something about the limb darkening of the star. So you have four things you can measure. There are four things you need to know. You do the fit, and what comes out is these numbers that I showed you earlier. So it turns out the planet's radius is 1.35 times the radius of Jupiter, give or take about 0.05, some numbers like that. Mass of the planet is determined from radial velocities, as is the semi-major axis of the orbit. Mass is 0.7 Jupiter masses. I'm sorry, it's 0.7 Jupiter radii. It says so right there. My apologies. So from this you can compute a density, which is real low. It's 0.3 or something like that. And that tells you right away that this thing is not a rocky planet. It's made mostly of hydrogen. And in fact, some nice work that Adam Burrows and Tristan and that group did suggests that, in fact, for the radius to be that big, that planet cannot have sat at a great distance from the star for very long after it formed. If it had, it would have cooled off and shrunk. And bringing it back in close to the star wouldn't have re-expanded it. It just would have puffed up the atmosphere, which isn't enough. So an implication of the radius being this large is that it arrived close to its star within about 10 million years of its formation time. And that's interesting. That tells you something about the process that got it there, although we're not quite sure what.
We have an idea of the age of the brown star.
It's hard to know for sure, but I think there's no evidence that it isn't a couple of billion years old, something like that. It's real hard to get reliable age estimates for sun-like stars. About the best you can do is say something about their activity level, which is closely tied to their rotation speed. And this is a medium-slow rotator, in fact. So it's got to be pretty old. Or statistically, it ought to be pretty old.
What's the central pressure?
The central pressure?
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah.
It's going to be very... 10 megabars or something like that.
Peace. So the whole, based on what Dave said this morning, the whole interior is really of interest to experiments.
It's a smaller mass than Jupiter.
Okay. It comes out to be 1.1 solar radii. Those numbers depend a little bit on the estimate of the mass of the star, but it's really very similar to the sun, as it turns out. So probably we know those numbers pretty well.
Quick question.
Yeah.
If you were looking not in the visible, but say in the infrared, would it look as if it were just a mask as it's been doing it here?
No, I'll come back to that. Good point, sure. And then this photometry is good enough. The individual, the scatter in the individual data points is about 1 part in 10^4, which is about the amount of light that the Earth would obstruct if it passed between, I'll get you in a minute, between the star and us. And so you can ask questions like, does this planet have satellites that are comparable in size to the Earth? And the answer is at the level of 1.2 Earth radii satellites, no, we don't see anything. Essentially, the data can be, they go back to the light curve. So this, the blue curve that underlies the points there is a model that consists of an opaque disk passing in front of a limb-darkened star with specified radii and a specified limb darkening and specified impact parameter. And those fit, that model fits the data within the internal scatter. As far as you can tell, there's nothing else there. Yeah, question.
Can you tell us about the error bars if you fit, I mean, the parameters on the next transparency?
Sorry, yes?
Yeah, what do you know? What's the error bar?
This is 1.35 plus or minus about 0.06. Jupiter radii. The mass is known, I think, to about 0.03 or something like that, Jupiter masses. The inclination is known to a quarter of a degree. That's something you get out with ridiculous precision and you don't care about it a whit. It is kind of interesting that you can get the stellar radius out as an independent parameter. That's cute.
You need the inclination to get the mass there.
Sorry?
You need the inclination to get the mass.
Well, formally, yes, but since it comes in as the cosine, you're up on the top of the cosine, it doesn't matter very much.
You discovered any other planets in that system that need to start caring about the inclination?
Yeah, that's right. You can ask yourself, actually, maybe a reason to care about the inclination is that if there is something else in the orbit's precessing.
Yeah.
Then you'll see that inclination change with time. And that would be pretty interesting.
Useful for studying the dynamical stability of the system.
Yeah. So maybe it's not totally uninteresting. Okay.
I have one more quick question.
Yes.
Can you estimate, do you see any evidence for moons around this planet in your HST data?
No, there's no evidence for moons down to a radius of 1.2 Earth radii. And you can also look for moons by watching for timing changes in the transits. And that gives you an estimate of the maximum mass that a moon could have, and that turns out to be about 3 Earth masses. So there's nothing as large as 3 Earth masses out at the Hill sphere radius, anyway, orbiting this planet.
Compared to
what we see in our solar system, of course, that's not a strong constraint.
That's right.
Because the upper bound, the lower bound that you're getting is much, much higher than, you know, Ganymede, Titan, those kinds of objects.
Yeah, there are no objects.
Not see those kinds of objects.
We could not see any of the object, any of the satellites that exist in the solar system. However, it's probably worth noticing that if you were to build a special purpose telescope that would look at transits regularly, every time they happened, and that unlike the Hubble is not in a close Earth orbit so that you miss half of every transit because it's behind the Earth, then it would take you about 100 orbits, which is to say about a year, to determine if there's something the size of Ganymede orbiting this planet.
Simply if there were a Saturn-type ring, you could see it.
That's right. In fact, we did look for that, and the limit you set on that is just about like Saturn's rings, assuming it's completely opaque, which Saturn's rings aren't. So it's not, there's no evidence for rings, but it's not a real tight constraint relative to the ring systems we see in our solar system.
Is anybody monitoring this star to
look
for other planets?
Oh, surely. Not transits, but radial velocities for sure. That's probably the best way to do it. If you think about our solar system, and think about dynamical stability, if there's another planet, it's got to be out at, 0.15 AU or something bigger than that. If it were in the same plane, then it would not show transits. Just because the inclination is big enough that you go three times further away and you're off the star completely. The distribution of inclinations of orbits in our solar system is big enough that something three times further out might have a chance to actually show transits, but you know, it's all guesswork, I guess. You'd have to be lucky. Whereas, excuse me, with radial velocities, you wouldn't have to be lucky. You just have to have a big mass. Okay, anything more about transit photometry right now? We may come back to it later. We talk about reflected light photometry. So here the problem is the traditional one. No convincing detections. Why is that? Well, it's because planets are real faint compared to stars. So this is a simplification of the traditional picture. You usually see spectrum lines and things on top of this. But so here I just put up black body curves. This is black body, 6,000 degree black body for a star. And then you put in orbit around that star a planet whose size is the size of, you know, this planet around HD, whatever, and whose orbital distance is the same. It turns out at that orbital distance, it intercepts 10 to the minus 4 of the light that is emitted by the star. And so if its albedo were 1, then this brightness ratio in reflected light, which is this part of the curve, would be 10 to the minus 4. So that's what you can expect the photometric signal to be in the visible. If you go out into the near to mid-infrared, past the black body peak of the planet, and you can guess that the planet's temperature has got to be 1,200, 1,500 degrees Kelvin. It'd be just a simple thermal equilibrium argument, radiative equilibrium. You get out to wavelengths longer than a few microns, and the thermal emission from the planet starts to dominate. And off in the Jean's tail, this ratio is more like a few hundred to one. And so in the infrared, your chances are better, and that's... we'll come back to that also. But for right now, let's talk about this wavelength range where you're looking at light that comes from the star, bounces off the planet, and comes to you. Thanks. So nobody's seen that yet, but I think there's a good chance that we will pretty soon. There's Hubble time allocated to look at the secondary transit. on HD whatever. And we know that the photometric precision is like 10 to the minus 4 from these measurements we already did. And so it ought to be possible to see the planet disappear behind the star on a fairly short time scale, so you don't have to depend on long-term stability of the instrument. If you can do that, then you got something about the geometric albedo, and you can do that as a function of wavelength. You can do it color by color within some limits. We figure we can get 4 or 5 bands. That tells you something about the atmospheric composition. You can match the models to get colors. It also tells you something about how much stellar energy is actually getting dumped into the atmosphere, because 1 minus the albedo is the part that gets eaten up.
So HST can do that in several bands and still have the sensitivity to see the secondary transit?
Well, we convinced the TAC that it could. We'll see if it's possible.
Okay.
So that's great if you have transits or if your photometer is stable for a long time. If you don't have transits, but you do have a stable photometer, you can do other stuff. And so this is a picture from Seeger, Whitney, and Sasolov. It's a bad reproduction. I apologize for that. This is basically the phase function. So it's the brightness of the planet that you see as a function of orbital phase as it goes around. So you see a varying crescent. And peaks up at full phase. And the point is that the shape of that peak can tell you things about the particle size distribution in the planetary atmosphere. That's what the difference is here. So these are big particles and those are little ones. So if there's meteorology going on in these atmospheres, which hard to think why there wouldn't be, then you might learn something about it by doing this kind of photometry. This is fairly tough stuff. I'm sorry you can't read these, but well, this is polarization. This is parts in 10 to the 6. This is just brightness, and it's parts in 10 to the, several parts in 10 to the 5, up to about one part in 10 to the, yeah, parts in 10 to the 5, is what you need for this. But I think that kind of stuff, we'll probably just be starting to do that 5 or 10 years' time. Okay, thermal emission. Here the idea is simply you go off into the long wavelength tail and you look at the light that comes to you directly emitted from the planet. And so you do the same secondary transit measurement, for instance, in the infrared, and that gives you a brightness ratio. You know the area of the planet. You know everything there is to know about the star. And so you can get essentially the dayside temperature or some number like that with some model fitting. It's not going to be terribly easy because of all the ugly molecular opacity sources that are going to be redistributing energy. You'd really like to have a spectrum. My guess is that in the near term, we're not going to see spectra. I don't think we have the sensitivity for it. But we might well do broadband photometry that's good to 10% or something like that.
You get the dayside temperature on the front transit, too.
That's right. And so that's the answer to your question. As the planet comes around the front side, the thermal emission will tend to fill in the transit. And so you'll see a shallower one than you would have expected to see based on the geometry. And if you can watch how the emission from this system varies as a function of orbital phase, and you can learn something about the temperature distribution from the day side and the night side of the planet. Now that's kind of cool. That's it's telling you something about the dynamics that redistribute energy from the place where it comes in to the places where it goes out.
What's the precision achieved?
As I said, the brightness ratio between the planet and the star at, say, 5 microns is going to be something like 400 to 1. Yes. And so if you want to do that to 10%, then you need 4,000 to 1. I don't know anybody who does infrared photometry at that kind of precision right now, but I don't know anybody who's been motivated to try either. So I'm just getting into that game, and a lot of other people have started on it already. I'd be surprised if we didn't see a detection of this kind of thing in the next year or so from the ground. And then, you know, as time goes on, the numbers will get better. Well, one thing that, a moral that I'll say at the end, but I might as well say it now, is doing any of these observations from space would be a real good thing. Because the troubles with the atmosphere are just ghastly. Okay, and then finally, transit spectroscopy, which I've been putting a lot of time into lately. Here the idea is this. So we talked about transits as the planet goes in front of the star, and you talk about the diameter of the planet, but the planet's a gas ball. So what do you mean by the diameter? Well, what do you mean by the limb? That's really the question. So the idea is, you know, here comes the starlight toward you. If you have a ray that's far from the center of the planet, it passes to you essentially unobstructed. If you have one that's real close to the center of the planet, it gets completely absorbed. Somewhere in between, there's going to be a place where rays get through with some absorption, but you know, they're slightly attenuated, but they still make it through. And so you might as well define the place where the tangential optical depth is 1, or some definition like that, as being the limb of the planet. But the optical depth is going to depend on the wavelength. And so what that means is the size of the planet is a function of wavelength. That's the way to think about it. So if you look at a place where the opacity is low, then a light ray can sneak through low down in the atmosphere. If you pick a nearby place, a molecular transition where the opacity is 10 to the 4 times higher, then you have to go up about 10 scale heights before you've lowered the density enough that the light can get through again. That means the planet looks bigger here and it absorbs more light. And I think Adam was talking about that.
This is also complicated by refraction in the atmosphere.
That's right, in principle. In practice, it doesn't matter in this case. The reason it doesn't matter is because the refraction is proportional to the vertical gradient of the refractive index. These planets are made out of hydrogen, which doesn't refract a whole lot to begin with. They're hot, they have low surface gravity, so the scale heights are very large. And so the vertical derivative of things like density is small relative to planets like, say, Uranus or Jupiter, where you have a larger surface gravity and a much lower temperature. And so other things being equal, you expect refraction at the same density level in Jupiter to be 30 times more important than it is here. And then finally, there are a lot of planetary people who have done refraction studies watching stars go behind planets. And they always come up to me and say, well, isn't that important? And the answer is, no, not really. And that's because instead of looking at a point source back here, you're looking at a star that's subtends 6 degrees in the sky. And so if this ray gets tipped so you don't see it, well, there's always another one coming in from a slightly different angle that gets turned so you do. excuse me. So the upshot is that the refractive deflection at the level at which the tangential optical depth is 1 in the lowest opacity regions is an arc minute or something like that. And the diameter of the background star is 6 degrees, and so it just doesn't matter. It's included in the calculations I do, but it doesn't matter.
Do you know if anyone has thought about the consequences of planet X having a magnetic field? Because then, of course, you'll have a magnetosphere, you'll have a building of that magnetosphere. The question is whether there are any particularly absorbing features, partially ionized species,
like that torque, which can then influence the appearance as it goes into transit.
Well, it sends me off in two directions. One is ionized stuff that could are atoms with strange states excited that you might not naively expect. And the best example there is helium. And Sarah Seeger and Dimitar Saslov pointed out that because of the ultraviolet flux in the star, you should expect that the triplet states of helium should be populated. And you might well expect a lot of absorption in helium 10-8-30, which is a line that you see in the solar chromosphere. It gets there because of X-ray irradiation from the corona. So it could well be that you'd see deep lines of helium in these planets. As far as magnetospheric stuff, Keith McGregor and I have spent a little time thinking about what the auroral signatures from these planets might be. And you can compute something about the auroral radiation that you might expect, given the, assume you just took Jupiter and moved it into 0.04 AU, left the magnetic field intact. Well, the magnetosphere shrinks because the ram pressure from the solar wind is bigger, but you work it all through, it turns out you should expect auroral emission that's about 1,000 times bigger than what you see from Jupiter, which is already a lot. Still, it's going to be hard to see that. It turns out to be a small number seen at 50 parsecs. I promised to go short, didn't I?
Yeah.
Let me just show you a few things quickly, then. Make the one physical point that's of interest about this spectroscopy game. There's really only one idea, and from that you can work out everything. And that is that the useful quantity is the ratio between the spectrum that you measure during transit and the spectrum you measure out of transit. You might as well subtract one from that, because this is nearly one. And it turns out that almost always you can interpret that as the variation in the planet's diameter with wavelength, as I told you. And a special case that's often useful is to suppose that the stuff that you're interested in is exponentially distributed, with its density is an exponential function of height in the atmosphere. So if you have an isothermal atmosphere with constant mixing ratio, that's what you get. In that case, this thing that you can measure is a constant of order unity. It depends on the scale height, and it depends on the logarithm of the opacity ratio. And so if you go from a place where the opacity is 1 in some units, change wavelengths a little bit, it becomes 10 to the 4. The result is that the radius of the planet increases by the log of 10 to the 4 scale heights. And that's almost all there is to it. So a result of that is you crank this into a model, and you can get model spectra. Again, I guess Adam Burrows showed you one of these. Mostly, you expect a lot of water vapor. You expect some carbon monoxide. You expect some methane, alkali metals. This minus 1.5% is just the amount of light that's obstructed by the planet at the place where it's the wavelength where its radius is smallest. And as you go to more opaque things, you gain another 1 or 1.5 tenths of a percent. And so this is a 10 to the minus 3 variation in the brightness of the star as a function of wavelength, or some number smaller than that. So you have to work to see it. But if you could, if you did, you could learn some stuff. And here's one example of the kind of thing you might learn. Think about clouds. Clouds, as a rule, don't have strong wavelength-dependent opacity. They tend to be really opaque at all wavelengths. And so if your light ray passes through above the cloud deck, it gets through unscathed. And if it hits the cloud deck, it gets absorbed, and there's not much in between. In that case, the planet looks kind of like a billiard ball, independent of wavelength, and you get something that looks like this bottom curve, where almost all of these variations have been eaten up because the regions of the atmosphere that make them are obscured by the clouds. If you lower the cloud deck, then you see more and more of the molecular signatures. And so, again, this is a way to learn something about meteorology on the planet. And I just hope, given all the work I'm putting into the observations, that it really looks more like this than that. But we'll see. Nature does what it does. Okay, since I want to try to be fairly brief, let me just assert that there are things like temperature diagnostics. Here's one, not my favorite, which works in this temperature range of around 1200 K. So here we have, this picture has to do not with temperature, but with metallicity. It's a curiosity the way the chemistry works that at a given temperature, the amount of methane that you get, since it's a distinctly minority species, depends only on the ratios of the atomic abundances and not on how much of either one there is. And so if you change the metallicity, then, did I do this right? Yeah. Then these two things, which are water lines, get stronger. All these guys, which are methane lines, this is if you increase the metallicity by a factor of 5. So you have a heavy element enriched atmosphere. Then you get more water lines, but the methane stays essentially the same. I'm sorry, I didn't explain that very well, but try again later if you're curious. Temperature diagnostics. Methane is a strong temperature indicator. So here you change the temperature of the model by 200 degrees, and the methane lines go from these essentially nothing. Lower the temperature 200 degrees and you get something, but not much, and lower it another 200 and you get a whole lot. There are others. The best one is just relative line depths, and that comes in because changing the temperature changes the scale height in the atmosphere. And remember, the line depths have a factor of the scale height in them. And so if you can measure relative line depths in a multiplet or in a band that all come from the same stuff, you can learn something about the temperature of the atmosphere, maybe even the temperature structure. Let me not talk about winds. Let me just say, obviously, these spectral features are going to be Doppler shifted. And so if there are winds that blow from the day side to the night side, say, then you'll find that the radial velocity of the features that you look at is not the same as the radial velocity that the ephemeris of the planet says it has to have. So by looking at that difference, you can learn about the winds on this funny little annular region around the terminator of the planet, because that's all you get to observe.
Temperature, too, etc. All the information.
That's right. Everything you learn from transit spectroscopy falls right at the day-night transition. And that can be good or bad depending on your circumstances. Well, can you do it? Let me show you a spectrum that we got 4 months ago. This top trace is one spectrum of HD 209 blah blah blah, taken with the near spectrograph on the Keck 2 telescope. It's about a 3-minute exposure, and the bottom is a model of the atmospheric transmission of the atmosphere of the Earth, mind you. And this shows you right away the good news and the bad news. The good news is that I can't prove it to you from this one picture, but if I showed you two pictures, you'd see that the noise on this thing is close to invisible. It's real small. There is an instrumental problem, which is these interference fringes, but they're fairly repeatable. But the trouble is that This is a region where what you'd like to look at is the first overtone band of carbon monoxide, which turns on about here. But it's all trashed up with this atmospheric methane. And the depths of these features are large, and of course they change with time because you're looking through more or less depending on how high the star is in the sky. So the chief challenge in data reduction is getting rid of this junk and leaving behind what you really want, so you can do that ratio and have it that I showed you earlier and have it make sense. I think what we've learned from looking at these data is that this particular data set, which was not particularly fortuitous in the sense that the transit that we were observing started when the star was about that high in the sky, and it ended up, you know, up there. So there's a huge change in air mass during the transit, and the spectrum that we had to compare it with is all taken at low air mass, and then it clouded up, and we never got a comparison spectrum at high air mass. So that clouds these instrumental problems, suggests that you could do better. Nevertheless, I think we're within a factor of about 2 or 3 of being able to test models of the sort that I just showed you. So I think that hasn't been done yet, but I think it's likely doable. And within a few years, we ought to start seeing some results out of that. And I'll let you know when that happens. Okay, I think maybe I'll stop there and ask a question. Yeah.
How many stars are being monitored for transits?
Ooh. I couldn't begin to tell you, really. It's on the order of if I combine the different groups who are looking at things, each need to back up and tell you what I'm talking about. There's a technique for looking for transits that involves looking at a wide field of view, 5 or 6 degrees square, and just watching every star in the field and waiting for it to blink. So that's searching for planets, but looking for transits. Typically, you get a few thousand stars in each of those fields that are bright enough that you can do the photometry as well as you need to. There are probably 3 groups or something like that in the world now who are doing that at any given time. And each one of them is looking at a couple or 3 fields. So put it all together, you know, I don't know, 20, 40,000 stars, some number like that.
Shouldn't you see more by now?
The truth is, nobody has yet figured out how to do the photometry well enough to get the false alarm rate down to where it needs to be. Our group has, people ask me this all the time, and it's embarrassing. There's a succinct way to say it. Nothing fails like success. And so we found this one transiting planet a year ago, and since then we've been so distracted doing these follow-up observations on that one that we just haven't had time to pursue our wide field photometry. And so it's been on the shelf for a year. What can you do? There's only so much manpower. So that's the answer. I hope that's the answer where our bunch is concerned. I can't really speak for the other folks.
Is it possible to automate it, like the supernova searches?
Oh, yeah. I think it has to be done if we're going to do it in a large scale. But first, we have to convince ourselves that we know what we're doing. Yeah.
As a planet detection technique, how do you separate the, I don't know, what if it were a sunspot?
The
spots really good-sized spots.
Well, first, let me make an obvious comment, which is if you see a dip in the light curve, and you think it might be a planet, then you immediately realize that there are a lot of other things it could be. So you know that the radii of substellar objects between a tenth of a solar mass and Jupiter's mass doesn't depend on the mass. So until you've gone and measured the radial velocities, even if you have a dip that's the right size, you don't know what it is, even if it is a substellar object. It could be a brown dwarf, could be an M dwarf, could be a planet, you don't know, no way to tell. If the signal to noise isn't so great, which is typically the case, then you don't know if you have a grazing eclipse by something that's genuinely a star. And so you can have two stars that are doing this, okay? And they chop off just this little bit every orbit. And believe me, those are a headache. That happens. And again, the only way to separate that out is to go look at the radial velocities. And when that happens, you see plus or minus 100 kilometers a second instead of 100 meters a second. And you say, oh, well, foiled again. As for sunspots, there what you have going for you is a difference in timescales, really. Also amplitude. Except on very active stars, you don't typically see spots that block as much as a percent of the light of the star. And if they do, then they are evolving with time fast enough that the light curves don't really look anything like the light curves that you expect here. The light curve for a planet is it's essentially flat for a long time, then you get a dip, and then it repeats an orbit later. And for sunspots, these things just wander around on a rotational timescale. Color dependence also is a way to discriminate against spots. If you think you have something that might be a planet, but you're afraid it could be a spot, then you look at it in different colors, and the spot has color dependence, the planet doesn't. So there are ways to tell, but now the first thing you do is you look at your 40,000 stars and you try to get a short list of stars you think are interesting. And then you go do the interviews.
I have a comment to just say that the future of transits looks very bright. We have a few space missions, Corot, Mons, MOST, have been accepted, Kepler, and it's a method that can yield, as you said, temperatures, winds, if you have high sensitivity. And also, once you detect a planet by transit, you can, with a space mission, you can detect a small planet, Uranus size or even Earth size with Kepler, and then you can do radial velocimetry on that, because you know the planet is there, you know its phase, and then you can get mass of even smaller objects. Whereas when you simply look for something and you don't know that the planet is there, you can't reach that accuracy. So we really should have incredible results in the next 10 years.
My opinion is that, well, I mean, eclipsing binaries have played a real important role in the study of stars. And I think transits are going to play an important role in the study of planets for the same kind of reasons. You know, nature is offering to do you a favor here. You should say thank you.
Okay. I guess we'll have a
need a well. Thanks for your attention.